With its formal closure, thousands more workers joined the swelling army of the unemployed, and homeless men took up residence among the great, abandoned palaces of the fair. The poor had come lean and hungry out of the terrible winter that followed the World's Fair, wrote novelist Robert Herrick in The Web of Life. In that beautiful enterprise, the prodigal city had put forth her utmost strength, and having shown the world the supreme flower of her energy, had collapsed. The city's huge garment was too large for it. Miles of empty stores, hotels, flat buildings showed its shrunken state. Tens of thousands of human beings, lured to the festive city by abnormal wages, had been left stranded, without food or a right to shelter in its tenantless buildings. It was the contrast that was so wrenching. What a spectacle, wrote Ray Stannard Baker in his American Chronicle. What a human downfall after the magnificence and prodigality of the World's Fair, which had so recently closed its doors. Heights of splendor, pride, exaltation in one month, depths of wretchedness, suffering, hunger, cold in the next. In that first brutal winter, Burnham's photographer Charles Arnold took a very different series of photographs. One shows the machinery building soiled by smoke and litter. A dark liquid had been thrown against one wall. At the base of a column was a large box, apparently the home of an out-of-work squatter. It is desolation, wrote Teresa Dean, the columnist, about a visit she made to Jackson Park on January 2, 1894. You wish you had not come. If there were not so many around, you would reach out your arms, with the prayer on your lips for it all to come back to you. It seems cruel, cruel to give us such a vision. To let us dream and drift through heaven for 6 months, and then to take it out of our lives. 6 days after her visit, the first fires occurred and destroyed several structures, among them the famous peristyle. The following morning, Big Mary, chipped and soiled, stood over a landscape of twisted and blackened steel. The winter became a crucible for American labor. To workers, Eugene Debs and Samuel Gompers came increasingly to seem like saviors, Chicago's merchant princes like devils. George Pullman continued to cut jobs and wages without reducing rents, even though his company's treasury was flush with over $60 million in cash. Pullman's friends cautioned that he was being pig-headed and had underestimated the anger of his workers. He moved his family out of Chicago and hid his best china. On May 11, 1894, 2,000 Pullman workers went on strike with the support of Debs's American Railway Union. Other strikes broke out around the country, and Debs began planning a nationwide general strike to begin in July. President Cleveland ordered federal troops to Chicago and placed them under the command of General Nelson A. Miles, previously the Grand Marshal of the Exposition. Miles was uneasy about his new command. He sensed in the spreading unrest something unprecedented, more threatening and far-reaching than anything that had occurred before. He followed orders, however, and the former Grand Marshal of the fair wound up fighting the men who had built it. Strikers blocked trains and burned rail cars. On July 5, 1894, arsonists set fire to the 7 greatest palaces of the exposition. Post's immense manufacturers building, Hunt's dome, Sullivan's golden door, all of them. In the loop, men and women gathered on rooftops and in the highest offices of the rookery, the Masonic temple, the temperance tower, and every other high place to watch the distant conflagration. Flames rose 100 feet into the night sky and cast their gleam far out onto the lake. Belatedly, Burnham had gotten his wish. There was no regret, observed the Chicago Tribune, rather a feeling of pleasure that the elements and not the wrecker should wipe out the spectacle of the Columbian season. Later, in the next year, came the wonder. There are hundreds of people who went to Chicago to see the fair and were never heard from again, said the New York World. The list of the missing when the fair closed was a long one, and in the greater number, foul play suspected. Did these visitors to the fair, strangers to Chicago, find their way to Holmes's castle in answer to delusive advertisements sent out by him, never to return again? Did he erect his castle close to the fairgrounds so as to gather in these victims by the wholesale? The Chicago police had no answers, other than the obvious. That in Chicago, in the time of the fair, it was so very easy to disappear. Part 4. Cruelty Revealed, 1894 to 1895. Property of H. H. Holmes. Detective Frank Geyer was a big man with a pleasant, earnest face, a large walrus mustache, and a new gravity in his gaze and demeanor. He was one of Philadelphia's top detectives and had been a member of the force for 20 years, during which time he had investigated some 200 killings. He knew murder and its unchanging templates. Husbands killed wives, wives killed husbands, the poor killed one another, always for the usual motives of money, jealousy, passion, and love. Rarely did a murder involve the mysterious elements of dime novels or the stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. From the start, however, Geyer's current assignment had veered from the ordinary. One unusual aspect was that the suspect already was in custody, arrested November 17, 1894, for insurance fraud. The suspect was a physician whose given name was Mudgett, but who was known more commonly by the alias H. H. Holmes. He once had lived in Chicago, where he and an associate, Benjamin Pitetzel, had run a hotel during the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893. They had moved next to Fort Worth, Texas, then to St. Louis, and on to Philadelphia, committing frauds along the way. In Philadelphia, Holmes had swindled the Fidelity Mutual Life Association of nearly $10,000 by apparently faking the death of a policyholder, Ben Pitetzel. Holmes had bought the insurance in 1893 from Fidelity's Chicago office, just before the close of the exposition. As evidence of fraud accumulated, Fidelity had hired the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, the eye that never sleeps, to search for Holmes. The agency's operatives picked up his trail in Burlington, Vermont, and followed him to Boston, where they arranged to have him arrested by police. Holmes confessed to the fraud and agreed to be extradited to Philadelphia for trial. At that point, the case appeared to be closed. But now it was June 1895. 7 months had passed since Holmes's arrest, and it was becoming increasingly apparent that he had not faked the death of Ben Pitetzel. He had killed him, and then arranged the scene to make the death seem accidental. Now, three of Pitetzel's 5 children, Alice, Nellie, and Howard, were missing, last seen in Holmes's company. Geyer's assignment was to find the children. He was invited to join the case by Philadelphia District Attorney George S. Graham, who over the years had come to rely on Geyer for the city's most sensitive investigations. Graham had thought twice this time, however, for he knew that just a few months earlier Geyer had lost his wife Martha and his 12-year-old daughter Esther in a house fire. Geyer interviewed Holmes in his cell, but learned nothing new. Holmes insisted that when he had last seen the children, they were alive, and traveling with an accomplice named Minnie Williams, en route to the place where their father was hiding out. Geyer found Holmes to be smooth and glib, a social chameleon. Holmes is greatly given to lying with a sort of florid ornamentation, Geyer wrote, and all of his stories are decorated with flamboyant draperies, intended by him to strengthen the plausibility of his statements. In talking, he has the appearance of candor, becomes pathetic at times when pathos will serve him best, uttering his words with a quaver in his voice, often accompanied by a moistened eye, then turning quickly with a determined and forceful method of speech, as if indignation or resolution had sprung out of tender memories that had touched his heart. Holmes claimed to have secured a cadaver that resembled Pitatzel and to have placed it on the second floor of a house rented especially for the fraud. By coincidence or out of some malignant expression of humor, the house was located right behind the city morgue, a few blocks north of City Hall. Holmes admitted arranging the cadaver to suggest that Pitatzel had died in an accidental explosion. He poured a solvent on the cadaver's upper body and set it on fire, then positioned the body on the floor in direct sunlight. By the time the body was discovered, its features had been distorted well beyond recognition. Holmes volunteered to assist the coroner in making an identification. At the morgue, he had not only helped locate a distinctive wart on the dead man's neck, he pulled out his own lancet and removed the wart himself, then matter-of-factly handed it to the coroner. The coroner had wanted a member of the Pitatzel family also to be present at the identification. Pitatzel's wife, Carrie, was ill and could not come. Instead, she sent her second eldest daughter, Alice, 15 years old. The coroner's men draped the body so as to allow Alice to see only Pitatzel's teeth. She seemed confident that the corpse was her father. Fidelity paid the death benefit. Next, Holmes traveled to St. Louis, where the Pitatzel family now lived. Still in possession of Alice, he persuaded Carrie to let him pick up two more of her children, explaining that their father, in hiding, was desperate to see them. He took Nellie, 11, and Howard, 8, and embarked with all three children on a strange, sad journey. Geyer knew from Alice's letters that initially she found the trip to be something of an adventure. In a letter to her mother dated September 20, 1894, Alice wrote, "I wish you could see what I have seen." In the same letter she expressed her distaste for Holmes's treacly manner. "I don't like him to call me babe and child and dear and all such trash." The next day she wrote again, "Mama, have you ever seen or tasted a red banana? I have had three. They are so big that I can just reach around it and have my thumb and next finger just touch." Since leaving St. Louis, Alice had heard nothing from home and feared her mother's illness might have gotten much worse. "Have you gotten four letters from me besides this?" Alice wrote. "Are you sick in bed yet, or are you up? I wish that I could hear from you." One of the few things that Detective Geyer knew with certainty was that neither of these letters ever reached Carrie Pitatzel. Alice and Nellie had written to their mother repeatedly while in Holmes's custody, and had given the letters to Holmes with the expectation that he would mail them. He never did. Shortly after his arrest, police discovered a tin box marked "Property of H.H. Holmes," containing various documents and a dozen letters from the girls. He had stored them in the box as if they were seashells collected from a beach. Now Mrs. Pitatzel was nearly crushed with anxiety and grief, despite Holmes's latest assurances that Alice, Nellie, and Howard were in London, England, under the able care of Minnie Williams. A search by Scotland Yard had found no trace of any of them. Geyer had little hope that his own search would fare any better. With more than half a year having elapsed since anyone had heard from the children, Geyer wrote, "It did not look like a very encouraging task to undertake, and it was the general belief of all interested that the children would never be found." The district attorney believed, however, that another final effort to find the children should be made for the sake of the stricken mother, if for nothing else. I was not placed under any restrictions, but was told to go and exercise my own judgment in the matter, and to follow wherever the clues led me. Guyer set out on his search on the evening of June 26, 1895, a hot night in a hot summer. Earlier in June, a zone of high pressure, the permanent high, had settled over the mid-Atlantic states and driven temperatures in Philadelphia well into the 90s. A humid stillness held the countryside. Even at night, the air inside Guyer's train was stagnant and moist. Leftover cigar smoke drifted from men's suits, and at each stop the roar of frogs and crickets filled the air. Guyer slept in jagged stretches. The next day, as the train sped west through the heat-steamed hollows of Pennsylvania and Ohio, Guyer reread his copies of the children's letters to look for anything he might have missed that could help direct his search. The letters not only provided irrefutable proof that the children had been with Holmes, but contained enough geographic references to allow Guyer to plot the broad contours of the route he and the children had followed. Their first stop appeared to have been Cincinnati. Guyer reached Cincinnati at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, June 27th. He checked into the Palace Hotel. The next morning he went to police headquarters to brief the city's police superintendent on his mission. The superintendent assigned a detective to assist him, Detective John Schnooks, an old friend of Guyer's. Guyer hoped to reconstruct the children's travels from Cincinnati onward. There was no easy way to achieve his goal. He had few tools other than his wits, his notebook, a handful of photographs, and the children's letters. He and Detective Schnooks made a list of all the hotels in Cincinnati located near railroad stations, then set out on foot to visit each one and check its registrations for some sign of the children and Holmes. That Holmes would use an alias seemed beyond doubt, so Guyer brought along his photographs, even a depiction of the children's distinctive flat-top trunk. 9 months had passed since the children had written their letters, however. Guyer had little hope that anyone would remember one man and three children. On that point, as it happens, he was wrong. The detectives trudged from one hotel to the next. The day got hotter and hotter. The detectives were courteous and never showed impatience, despite having to make the same introductions and tell the same story over and over again. On Central Avenue, they came to a small, inexpensive hotel, the Atlantic House. As they had done at all the other hotels, they asked the clerk if they could see his registration book. They turned first to Friday, September 28, 1894, the day that Holmes, while already in possession of Alice, had picked up Nellie and Howard from their St. Louis home. Guyer guessed Holmes and the children had reached Cincinnati later that same Friday. Guyer ran his finger down the page for September 28th, and stopped at an entry for Alex E. Cook, a guest who, according to the register, was traveling with three children. The entry jogged Guyer's memory. Holmes had used the name before to rent a house in Burlington, Vermont. Also, Guyer by now had seen a lot of Holmes's handwriting. The writing in the ledger looked familiar. The Cook party stayed only one night, the register showed. But Guyer knew from the girls' letters that they had remained in Cincinnati at least two more days. It seemed odd that Holmes would go to the trouble of moving to a second hotel, but Guyer knew from experience that making assumptions about the behavior of criminals was always a dangerous thing. He and Schnooks thanked the clerk for his kind attention, then set out to canvass more hotels. The sun was high, the streets steamed. Cicadas scratched off messages from every tree. At 6th and Vine, the detectives came to a hotel called the Bristol and discovered that on Saturday, September 29th, 1894, a party identified as A. E. Cook had checked in with three children. When the clerk saw Guyer's photographs, he confirmed that the guests were Holmes, Alice, Nellie, and Howard. They checked out the next morning, Sunday, September 30th. The date fit the likely chronology of events. Guyer knew from the children's letters that on that Sunday morning, they had left Cincinnati and by evening had arrived in Indianapolis. Geyer was not yet ready to leave Cincinnati, however. Now he played a hunch. The Pinkertons had found that Holmes sometimes rented houses in the cities through which he traveled, as he had done in Burlington. Geyer and Schnucks turned their attention to Cincinnati's real estate agents. Their search eventually took them to the realty office of J.C. Thomas on East 3rd Street. Something about Holmes must have caused people to take notice, because both Thomas and his clerk remembered him. Holmes had rented a house at 305 Poplar Street under the name A.C. Hayes and had made a substantial advance payment. The date of the agreement, Thomas said, was September 28, 1894, the Friday when Holmes and the children had arrived in Cincinnati. Holmes held the house only 2 days. Thomas could offer no further details but referred the detectives to a woman named Henrietta Hill, who lived next door to the house. Geyer and Schnucks immediately set out for Miss Hill's residence and found her to be an acute observer and a willing gossip. "There is really very little to tell," she said. Then told them a lot. She first had noticed the new tenant on Saturday, September 29th, when a furniture wagon stopped in front of the rental house. A man and a boy descended. What most caught Miss Hill's attention was the fact the furniture wagon was empty, save for an iron stove that seemed much too large for a private residence. Miss Hill found the stove sufficiently strange that she mentioned it to her neighbors. The next morning, Holmes came to her front door and told her he was not going to stay in the house after all. If she wanted the stove, he said, she could have it. Detective Geyer theorized that Holmes must have sensed an excess of neighborly scrutiny and changed his plans. But what were those plans? At the time, Geyer wrote, "I was not able to appreciate the intense significance of the renting of the Poplar Street house and the delivery of a stove of such immense size." He was certain, however, that he had taken firm hold of the end of the string that would lead to the children. Based on the girl's letters, Geyer's next stop was obvious. He thanked Detective Schnucks for his companionship and caught a train to Indianapolis. It was even hotter in Indianapolis. Leaves hung in the stillness like hands of the newly dead. Early Sunday morning, Geyer went to the police station and picked up a new local partner, Detective David Richards. One part of the trail was easy to find. In Nellie Pittitzel's letter from Indianapolis, she had written, "We are at the English H." Detective Richards knew the place, the Hotel English. In the hotel's register, Geyer found an entry on September 30th for 3 Canning children. Canning, he knew, was Carrie Pittitzel's maiden name. Nothing was simple, however. According to the register, the Canning children had checked out the next day, Monday, October 1st. Yet Geyer knew, again from their letters, that the children had remained in Indianapolis for at least another week. Holmes seemed to be repeating the pattern he had established in Cincinnati. Geyer began the same methodical canvass he had conducted in Cincinnati. He and Detective Richards checked hotel after hotel, but found no further reference to the children. They did, however, find something else. At a hotel called the Circle Park, they discovered an entry for a Mrs. Georgia Howard. Howard was one of Holmes's more common aliases, Geyer now knew. He believed this woman could be Holmes's latest wife, Georgiana Yoke. The register showed that Mrs. Howard had checked in on Sunday, September 30th, 1894, and stayed 4 nights. Geyer showed his photographs to the hotel's proprietor, a Mrs. Rhodius, who recognized Holmes and Yoke, but not the children. Mrs. Rhodius and Yoke had become friends. In one conversation, Yoke told her that her husband was a very wealthy man and that he owned real estate and cattle ranches in Texas. also had considerable real estate in Berlin, Germany, where they intended to go as soon as her husband could get his business affairs into shape to leave. The timing of all these hotel stays was perplexing. As best Geyer could tell, on that one Sunday, September 30th, Holmes somehow had managed to maneuver the three children and his own wife into different hotels in the same city, without revealing their existence to each other. But where had the children gone next? Geyer and Richards examined the registers of every hotel and boarding house in Indianapolis, but found no further trace of the children. The Indianapolis leg of Geyer's search seemed to have reached a dead end when Richards remembered that a hotel called the Circle House had been opened during the fall of 1894, but had since closed. He and Geyer checked with other hotels to find out who had run the Circle House and learned from its former clerk that the registration records were in the possession of a downtown attorney. The records had been poorly kept, but among the guests who had arrived on Monday, October 1st, Geyer found a familiar entry, three Canning children. The register showed the children were from Galva, Illinois, the town where Mrs. Pititzel had grown up. Geyer now felt a pressing need to talk to the hotel's past manager, and found him running a saloon in West Indianapolis. His name was Herman Acalo. Geyer explained his mission and immediately showed Acalo his photographs of Holmes and the Pititzel children. Acalo was silent a moment. Yes, he said. He was sure of it. The man in the photograph had come to his hotel. It was the children, however, that he remembered most clearly, and now he told the detectives why. Until this point, all Geyer knew about the children's stay in Indianapolis was what he had read in the letters from the tin box. Between October 6th and 8th, Alice and Nellie had written at least three letters that Holmes had intercepted. The letters were brief and poorly written, but they offered small, bright glimpses into the daily lives of the children and the state of near captivity in which Holmes held them. "We are all well here," Nellie wrote on Saturday, October 6th. "It is a little warmer today. There is so many buggies go by that you can't hear yourself think. I first wrote you a letter with a crystal pen. It is all glass, so I have to be careful or else it will break. It was only 5 cents." Alice wrote a letter the same day. She had been away from her mother the longest, and for her the trip had become wearisome and sad. It was Saturday, raining hard. She had a cold and was reading Uncle Tom's Cabin so much that her eyes had begun to hurt. "And I expect this Sunday will pass away slower than I don't know what. Why don't you write to me? I have not got a letter from you since I have been away, and it will be 3 weeks day after tomorrow." On Monday, Holmes allowed a letter from Mrs. Pititzel to reach the children, which prompted Alice to write an immediate reply, observing, "It seems as though you were awful homesick." In this letter, which Holmes never mailed, Alice reported that little Howard was being difficult. "One morning Mr. H. told me to tell him to stay in the next morning, that he wanted him, and he would come and get him and take him out." But Howard had not obeyed, and when Holmes came for him, the boy was nowhere to be found. Holmes had gotten angry. Despite her sorrow and boredom, Alice found a few cheery moments worth celebrating. "Yesterday we had mashed potatoes, grapes, chicken, glass of milk each, ice cream each, a big sauce dish full, awful good too, lemon pie, cake. Don't you think that is pretty good?" The fact the children were so well fed might have comforted Mrs. Pititzel, had she ever received the letter. Not so, however, the story the former hotel manager now told Geyer. Each day Acalo would send his eldest son up to the children's room to call them for their meals. Often the boy reported back that the children were crying, evidently heartbroken and homesick to see their mother or hear from her, Geyer wrote. A German chambermaid named Carolyn Klausmann had tended the children's room and observed the same wrenching scenes. She had moved to Chicago, Akelo said. Geyer wrote her name in his notebook. Holmes said that Howard was a very bad boy, Akelo recalled, and that he was trying to place him in some institution or bind him out to some farmer as he wanted to get rid of the responsibility of looking after him. Geyer still nurtured a small hope that the children really were alive, as Holmes insisted. Despite his 20 years on the police force, Geyer found it difficult to believe that anyone could kill 3 children for absolutely no reason. Why had Holmes gone to the trouble and expense of moving the children from city to city, hotel to hotel, if only to kill them? Why had he bought each of them a crystal pen and taken them to the zoo in Cincinnati and made sure they received lemon pie and ice cream? With each new step in the search, however, the story became only more sinister. The insurance fraud, a portal to something infinitely more grotesque. Geyer set out for Chicago, but felt deep reluctance about leaving Indianapolis. Something seemed to tell me that Howard had never left there alive. In Chicago, he found, to his surprise, that the city's police department knew nothing about Holmes. He tracked down Carolyn Klausman, who was now working at the Swiss Hotel on Clark Street. When he showed her his photographs of the children, tears welled in her eyes. Geyer caught a train to Detroit, the city where Alice had written the last of the letters in the tin box. Geyer was getting a feel for his quarry. There was nothing rational about Holmes, but his behavior seemed to follow a pattern. Geyer knew what to look for in Detroit, and with the assistance of another police detective, once again began a patient canvas of hotels and boarding houses. Though he told his story and showed his photographs 100 times, he never tired and was always patient and polite. These were his strengths. His weakness was his belief that evil had boundaries. Once again, he picked up the children's trail and the parallel registrations of Holmes and Yoke, but now he discovered something even stranger. That during this same period, Carrie Pittitzel and her 2 other children, Desi and Baby Wharton, had also checked into a Detroit hotel, this one called Geiss's Hotel. Geyer realized, to his astonishment, that Holmes now was moving 3 different parties of travelers from place to place, shoving them across the landscape as if they were toys. And he discovered something else. In walking from lodging to lodging, he saw not only that Holmes had kept Carrie away from Alice, Nellie, and Howard. He had placed them in establishments only 3 blocks apart. Suddenly, the true implication of what Holmes had done became clear to him. He reread Alice's final letter. She had written it to her grandparents on Sunday, October 14th, the same day in which her mother, along with Desi and the baby, had checked into Geiss's hotel. This was the saddest letter of them all. Alice and Nellie both had colds, and the weather had turned wintry. "Tell Mama that I have to have a coat," Alice wrote. "I nearly freeze in that thin jacket." The children's lack of warm clothing forced them to stay in their room day after day. "All that Nell and I can do is to draw, and I get so tired sitting that I could get up and fly almost. I wish I could see you all. I am getting so homesick that I don't know what to do. I suppose Wharton walks by this time, don't he? I would like to have him here. He would pass away the time a good deal." Geyer was appalled. So when this poor child Alice was writing to her grandparents in Galva, Illinois, complaining of the cold, sending a message to her mother, asking for heavier and more comfortable clothing, wishing for little Wharton, the baby who would help them pass away the time, while this wearied, lonely, homesick child was writing this letter, her mother and her sister and the much-wished-for Wharton were within 10 minutes' walk of her, and continued there for the next 5 days. It was a game for Holmes, Geyer realized. he possessed them all and reveled in his possession. One additional phrase of Alice's letter kept running through Geyer's brain. "Howard," she had written, "is not with us now." Moyamensing Prison. Holmes sat in his cell at Moyamensing Prison, a large, turreted and crenellated building at 10th and Reed Streets in South Philadelphia. He did not seem terribly troubled by his incarceration, although he complained of its injustice. "The great humiliation of feeling that I am a prisoner is killing me far more than any other discomforts I have to endure," he wrote, though in fact he felt no humiliation whatsoever. If he felt anything, it was a smug satisfaction that so far no one had been able to produce any concrete evidence that he had killed Ben Pititzel or the missing children. He occupied a cell that measured 9 by 14 feet, with a narrow, barred window high in its outer wall and a single electric lamp, which guards extinguished at 9 o'clock each night. The walls were whitewashed. The stone construction of the prison helped blunt the extreme heat that had settled on the city and much of the country, but nothing could keep out the humidity for which Philadelphia was notorious. It clung to Holmes and his fellow prisoners like a shawl of moist wool, yet this, too, he seemed not to mind. Holmes became a model prisoner, became, in fact, the model of a model prisoner. He made a game of using his charm to gain concessions from his keepers. He was allowed to wear his own clothes and to keep my watch and other small belongings. He discovered also that he could pay to have food, newspapers, and magazines brought in from outside. He read of his increasing national notoriety. He read also that Frank Geyer, a Philadelphia police detective who had interviewed him in June, was now in the Middle West searching for Pitetzel's children. The search delighted Holmes. It satisfied his profound need for attention and gave him a sense of power over the detective. He knew that Geyer's search would be in vain. Holmes's cell was furnished with a bed, a stool, and a writing table, upon which he composed his memoir. He had begun it, he said, the preceding winter. To be exact, on December 3rd, 1894. He began the memoir as if it were a fable. "Come with me, if you will, to a tiny, quiet New England village, nestling among the picturesquely rugged hills of New Hampshire. Here in the year 1861, I, Herman W. Mudgett, the author of these pages, was born. That the first years of my life were different from those of any other ordinary country-bred boy, I have no reason to think." The dates and places were correct. His description of his boyhood as a typical country idol was most certainly a fabrication. It is one of the defining characteristics of psychopaths that as children they lied at will, exhibited unusual cruelty to animals and other children, and often engaged in acts of vandalism, with arson an especially favored act. Holmes inserted into his memoir a prison diary, which he claimed to have kept since the day he arrived at Moyamensing. It is more likely that he invented the diary expressly for the memoir, intending it as a vehicle for reinforcing his claims of innocence by fostering the impression that he was a man of warmth and piety. He claimed in the diary to have established a daily schedule aimed at personal betterment. He would wake at 6:30 each day and take his usual sponge bath, then clean his cell. He would breakfast at 7. "I shall eat no more meat of any kind while I am so closely confined." He planned to exercise and read the morning newspapers until 10 o'clock. "From 10 to 12 and 2 to 4, 6 days in the week, I shall confine myself to my old medical works and other college studies, including stenography, French, and German." The rest of the day he would devote to reading various periodicals and library books. At one point in his diary, he notes that he was reading Trilby, the 1894 bestseller by George Du Maurier, about a young singer, Trilby O'Farrell, and her possession by the mesmerist Svengali. Holmes wrote that he was much pleased with parts of it. Elsewhere in the diary, Holmes went for the heart. One entry for May 16th, 1895, my birthday. Am 34 years old. I wonder if, as in former years, Mother will write me. In another entry, he described a visit from his latest wife, Georgiana Yoke. She has suffered, and though she tried heroically to keep me from seeing it, it was of no avail. And in a few minutes, to again bid her goodbye and know she was going out into the world with so heavy a load to bear, caused me more suffering than any death struggles can ever do. Each day until I know she is safe from harm and annoyance will be a living death to me. From his cell, Holmes also wrote a long letter to Carrie Pititzel, which he composed in a manner that shows he was aware the police were reading his mail. He insisted that Alice, Nellie, and Howard were with Miss W. in London, and that if the police would only check his story in detail, the mystery of the children would be solved. I was as careful of the children as if they were my own, and you know me well enough to judge me better than strangers here can do. Ben would not have done anything against me or I against him, any quicker than brothers. We never quarreled. Again, he was worth too much to me for me to have killed him, if I had no other reason not to. As to the children, I never will believe, until you tell me so yourself, that you think they are dead, or that I did anything to put them out of the way. Knowing me as you do, can you imagine me killing little and innocent children, especially without any motive? He explained the lack of mail from the children. They have no doubt written letters which Miss W., for her own safety, has withheld. Holmes read the daily papers closely. Clearly the detective's search had borne little fruit. Holmes had no doubt that soon Geyer would be forced to end his search and return to Philadelphia. The prospect of this was pleasing in the extreme. The Tenant. On Sunday, July 7, 1895, Detective Geyer took his search to Toronto, where the city's police department assigned Detective Alf Cuddy to assist him. Together, Geyer and Cuddy scoured the hotels and boarding houses of Toronto, and after days of searching found that here, too, Holmes had been moving three parties of travelers simultaneously. Holmes and Yoke had stayed at the Walker House. G. Howe and wife, Columbus. Mrs. Pititzel at the Union House. Mrs. C. A. Adams and daughter, Columbus. The girls at the Albion. Alice and Nellie Canning, Detroit. No one remembered seeing Howard. Now Geyer and Cuddy began searching the records of real estate agencies and contacting the owners of rental homes, but Toronto was far larger than any other city Geyer had searched. The task seemed impossible. On Monday morning, July 15th, he awoke facing the prospect of yet another day of mind-numbing routine, but when he arrived at headquarters, he found Detective Cuddy in an unusually good mood. A tip had come in that Cuddy found promising. A resident named Thomas Rives had read Holmes's description in a newspaper article and thought it sounded like a man who in October 1894 had rented the house next door to his at 16 St. Vincent Street. Geyer was leery. The intensive press coverage of his mission and his arrival in Toronto had generated thousands of tips, all useless. Cuddy agreed that the latest tip was probably another wild goose chase, but at least it offered a change of pace. By now, Geyer was a national fascination, America's Sherlock Holmes. Reports of his travels appeared in newspapers throughout the nation. In this day, the possibility that a man had killed three young children was still considered a horror well beyond the norm. There was something about Detective Geyer's lone search through the sweltering heat of that summer that captured everyone's imagination. He had become the living representation of how men liked to think of themselves. One man doing an awful duty and doing it well against the odds. Millions of people woke each morning hoping to read in their newspapers that this staunch detective at last had found the missing children. Geyer paid little attention to his new celebrity. Nearly a month had passed since the start of his search, but what had he accomplished? Each new phase seemed only to raise new questions. Why did Holmes take the children? Why had he engineered that contorted journey from city to city? What power did Holmes possess that gave him such control? There was something about Holmes that Geyer just did not understand. Every crime had a motive. But the force that propelled Holmes seemed to exist outside the world of Geyer's experience. He kept coming back to the same conclusion. Holmes was enjoying himself. He had arranged the insurance fraud for the money, but the rest of it was for fun. Holmes was testing his power to bend the lives of people. What irked Geyer most was that the central question was still unanswered. Where were the children now? The detectives found Thomas Rives to be a charming Scotsman of considerable age, who welcomed them with enthusiasm. Rives explained why the renter next door had caught his attention. For one thing, he arrived with little furniture. A mattress, an old bed, and an unusually large trunk. One afternoon, the tenant came to Rives' house to borrow a shovel, explaining that he wanted to dig a hole in the cellar for the storage of potatoes. He returned the shovel the next morning, and the following day removed the trunk from the house. Rives never saw him again. Detective Geyer, now galvanized, told Rives to meet him in front of the neighboring house in exactly 1 hour. Then he and Cuddy sped to the home of the realtor who had arranged the rental. With little preamble, Geyer showed her a photograph of Holmes. She recognized him instantly. He had been very handsome, with amazing blue eyes. "This seemed too good to be true," Geyer wrote. He and Cuddy offered quick thanks and rushed back to St. Vincent Street. Rives was waiting outside. Now Geyer asked to borrow a shovel, and Rives returned with the same one he had loaned the tenant. The house was charming, with a steeply pitched central gable and scalloped trim like the gingerbread house in a fairy tale. Except this house did not sit alone in a deep wood, but in the heart of Toronto, on a fine street closely lined with elegant homes and yards fenced with fleur-de-lis pickets. Clematis, in full bloom, climbed one post of the veranda. The current tenant, a Mrs. J. Armbrust, answered the door. Rives introduced the detectives. Mrs. Armbrust led them inside. They entered a central hall that divided the house into halves of 3 rooms each. A stairwell led to the second floor. Geyer asked to see the cellar. Mrs. Armbrust led the detectives into the kitchen, where she lifted a sheet of oilcloth from the floor. A square trap door lay underneath. As the detectives opened it, the scent of moist earth drifted upward into the kitchen. The cellar was shallow but very dark. Mrs. Armbrust brought lamps. Geyer and Cuddy descended a steep set of steps, more ladder than stairway, into a small chamber about 10 feet long by 10 feet wide and only 4 feet high. The lamps shed a shifting orange light that exaggerated the detective's shadows. Hunched over, wary of the overhead beams, Geyer and Cuddy tested the ground with the spade. In the southwest corner, Geyer found a soft spot. The spade entered with disconcerting ease. "Only a slight hole had been made," Geyer said, "when the gases burst forth and the stench was frightful." At 3 feet, they uncovered human bone. They summoned an undertaker named B.D. Humphrey to help recover the remains. Geyer and Cuddy gingerly climbed back down into the cellar. Humphrey leapt down. The stench now suffused the entire house. Mrs. Armbrust looked stricken. Then the coffins arrived. The undertaker's men put them in the kitchen. The children had been buried nude. Alice lay on her side, her head at the west end of the grave. Nellie lay face down, partially covering Alice. Her rich black hair, nicely plaited, lay along her back as neatly as if she had just combed it. The men spread a sheet on the cellar floor. They began with Nellie. "We lifted her as gently as possible," Geyer said, "but owing to the decomposed state of the body, the weight of her plaited hair hanging down her back pulled the scalp from her head." They discovered something else. Nellie's feet had been amputated. During the search of the residence that followed, police found no trace of them. At first, this seemed a mystery, until Geyer recalled that Nellie was club-footed. Holmes had disposed of her feet to remove this distinctive clue to her identity. Mrs. Pittitzel learned of the discovery of her girls by reading a morning newspaper. She had been visiting friends back in Chicago, and thus Geyer had been unable to telegraph the news to her directly. She caught a train to Toronto. Geyer met her at the station and took her to his hotel, the Rawson House. She was exhausted and sad and seemed perpetually near fainting. Geyer roused her with smelling salts. Geyer and Cuddy came for her the next afternoon to bring her to the morgue. They carried brandy and smelling salts. Geyer wrote, "I told her that it would be absolutely impossible for her to see anything but Alice's teeth and hair, and only the hair belonging to Nellie." This had a paralyzing effect upon her, and she almost fainted. Her situation had captured the city's heart. The coroner's men did what they could to make the viewing as endurable as possible. They cleaned the flesh from Alice's skull and carefully polished her teeth, then covered her body with canvas. They laid paper over her face and cut a hole in the paper to expose only her teeth, just as the Philadelphia coroner had done for her father. They washed Nellie's hair and laid it carefully on the canvas that covered Alice's body. Cuddy and Geyer took positions on opposite sides of Mrs. Pittitzel and led her into the dead house. She recognized Alice's teeth immediately. She turned to Geyer, "Where is Nellie?" and only then noticed Nellie's long black hair. The coroner, unable to find any marks of violence, theorized that Holmes had locked the girls in the big trunk, then filled it with gas from a lamp valve. Indeed, when police found the trunk, they discovered a hole drilled through one side, covered with a makeshift patch. "Nothing could be more surprising," Geyer wrote, "than the apparent ease with which Holmes murdered the two little girls in the very center of the city of Toronto, without arousing the least suspicion of a single person there. If not for Graham's decision to send him on his search, he believed, these murders would never have been discovered, and Mrs. Pittitzel would have gone to her grave without knowing whether her children were alive or dead." For Geyer, finding the girls was one of the most satisfactory events of my life. But his satisfaction was tempered by the fact that Howard remained missing. Mrs. Pittitzel refused to believe Howard was dead. She clung fondly to the hope that he would ultimately be found alive. Even Geyer found himself hoping that in this one case, Holmes had not lied and had done exactly what he had told the clerk in Indianapolis. Had he been placed in some institution, as Holmes had intimated his intention of doing, or was he hidden in some obscure place beyond reach or discovery? Was he alive or dead? I was puzzled, nonplussed, and groping in the dark. A lively corpse. In Philadelphia, on the morning of Tuesday, July 16, 1895, the day Geyer's Toronto discoveries were reported in the nation's newspapers, the district attorney's office telephoned an urgent message to the warden at Moyamensing Prison, instructing him to keep all the morning's newspapers away from Holmes. The order came from Assistant District Attorney Thomas W. Barlow. He wanted to surprise Holmes with the news, hoping it would rattle him so thoroughly that he would confess. Barlow's order came too late. The guards sent to intercept the morning papers found Holmes sitting at his table, reading the news as calmly as if reading about the weather. In his memoir, Holmes contended that the news did shock him. His newspaper came that morning at 8:30, as it always did, he wrote, and I had hardly opened it before I saw in large headlines the announcement of the finding of the children in Toronto. For the moment it seemed so impossible that I was inclined to think it one of the frequent newspaper excitements that had attended the earlier part of the case. But suddenly, he wrote, he realized what must have happened. Minnie Williams killed them, or had ordered them killed. Holmes knew she had an unsavory associate named Hatch. He guessed that Williams had suggested the killings, and Hatch had carried them out. It was all too horrible to comprehend. I gave up trying to read the article, and saw instead the two little faces as they had looked when I hurriedly left them. Felt the innocent child's kiss so timidly given, and heard again their earnest words of farewell, and I realized that I had received another burden to carry to my grave. I think at this time I should have lost my senses utterly had I not been hurriedly called to prepare to be taken to the district attorney's office. The morning was hot. Holmes was driven north on Broad Street to City Hall through air as sticky as taffy. In the DA's office, he was questioned by Barlow. The Philadelphia Public Ledger reported that Holmes's genius for explanation had deserted him. For 2 hours, he sat under a shower of questions and refused to talk. He was not cowed by any means, but he would give absolutely no satisfaction. Holmes wrote, "I was in no condition to bear his accusations, nor disposed to answer many of his questions." He told Barlow that Miss Williams and Hatch apparently had killed Howard as well. Holmes was driven back to Moyamensing. He began earnestly trying to find a publisher for his memoir, hoping to get it quickly into print to help turn public opinion to his favor. If he could not exert his great powers of persuasion directly, he could at least attempt to do so indirectly, in print. He struck a deal with a journalist named John King to arrange publication and market the book. He wrote to King, "My ideas are that you should get from the New York Herald and the Philadelphia Press all the cuts they have and turn those we want over to the printer to have them electroplated at his expense." In particular, he wanted a Herald picture of himself in a full beard. He wanted to have the autographs of my two names, Holmes and Mudgett, engraved and electroplated at the same time to go into the picture. He wanted this done quickly so that as soon as the manuscript was set in type, all components of the book would be in hand, ready for the presses. He offered King some marketing advice. "As soon as the book is published, get it onto the Philadelphia and New York newsstands. Then get reliable canvassers who will work afternoons here in Philadelphia. Take one good street at a time, leave the book, then return about a half hour later for the money. No use to do this in the forenoon when people are busy. I canvassed when a student in this way and found the method successful. Then if you have any liking for the road, go over the ground covered by the book, spending a few days in Chicago, Detroit, and Indianapolis. Give copies to the newspapers in these cities to comment upon. It will assist the sale." Aware that this letter, too, would be read by the authorities, Holmes used it to reinforce obliquely his claims of innocence. He urged King that when his sales effort took him to Chicago, he should go to a particular hotel and look for evidence in the register and collect affidavits from clerks proving that Minnie Williams had stayed there with Holmes long after she was supposed to have been murdered. If she was a corpse then, Holmes wrote to King, she was a very lively corpse indeed. All the weary days. It was a strange moment for Geyer. He had examined every lead, checked every hotel, visited every boarding house and real estate agent, and yet now he had to begin his search anew. Where? What path was left? The weather remained stifling, as if taunting him. His instincts kept telling him that Holmes had killed Howard in Indianapolis. He returned there on July 24th and again received the assistance of Detective David Richards, but now Geyer also called in the press. The next day, every newspaper in the city reported his arrival. Dozens of people visited him at his hotel to make suggestions about where he ought to look for Howard. The number of mysterious persons who had rented houses in and about Indianapolis multiplied from day to day, Geyer wrote. He and Richards trudged through the heat from office to office, house to house, and found nothing. Days came and passed, but I continued to be as much in the dark as ever, and it began to look as though the bold but clever criminal had outwitted the detectives, and that the disappearance of Howard Pittitzel would pass into history as an unsolved mystery. Meanwhile, the mystery of Holmes himself grew deeper and darker. Geyer's discovery of the girls prompted Chicago police to enter Holmes's building in Englewood. Each day they delved more deeply into the secrets of the castle, and each day turned up additional evidence that Holmes was something far worse than even Geyer's macabre discoveries indicated. There was speculation that during the World's Fair he might have killed dozens of people, most of them young women. One estimate, certainly an exaggeration, put the toll at 200. To most people, it seemed impossible that Holmes could have done so much killing without detection. Geyer would have agreed, except that his own search had revealed again and again Holmes's talent for deflecting scrutiny. Chicago detectives began their exploration of the castle on the night of Friday, July 19th. First, they made a broad survey of the building. The third floor contained small hotel rooms. The second floor had 35 rooms that were harder to classify. Some were ordinary bedrooms, others had no windows and were fitted with doors that made the rooms airtight. One room contained a walk-in vault with iron walls. Police found a gas jet with no apparent function other than to admit gas into the vault. Its cutoff valve was located in Holmes's personal apartment. In Holmes's office, they found a bank book belonging to a woman named Lucy Burbank. It listed a balance of $23,000. The woman could not be located. The eeriest phase of the investigation began when the police, holding their flickering lanterns high, entered the hotel basement, a cavern of brick and timber measuring 50 by 165 feet. The discoveries came quickly. A vat of acid with 8 ribs and part of a skull settled at the bottom. Mounds of quicklime. A large kiln. A dissection table stained with what seemed to be blood. They found surgical tools and charred high-heeled shoes. And more bones. 18 ribs from the torso of a female child. Several vertebrae. A bone from a foot. One shoulder blade. One hip socket. Articles of clothing emerged from walls and from pits of ash and quicklime, including a girl's dress and blood-stained overalls. Human hair clotted a stove